very happy to have Yingxuan give us a Zoom talk from Harvard on words to describe a black hole. Please take it away.
Thanks, Sabrina. So you can see my cursor moving or no? Okay, good. So thanks for inviting me. And sorry again that I couldn't visit in person because my travels are pretty constrained having a small kid at home. Okay, so the title of my talk is Words to Describe a Black Hole. And I will begin by showing this picture of taken by the Event Horizon Telescope of the image of a massive black hole that's at the center of our galaxy. So it's a black hole, but you observe this bright ring, which is the photon sphere. And you see there's a shadow inside, which is roughly speaking where the black hole is. So if we zoom in, I put in a picture of my collaborator, Qiming. He has done previous work on this subject that is actually important for what I'll be talking about today. So let me start by just reminding ourselves of why we love black holes so much. So black holes, they are a kind of conflict between our classical intuition and sort of the rules of quantum mechanics. This is a very old story that we want to reconcile quantum mechanics with gravity. And had we been fully successful in that, we should be able to describe black holes very well. So the puzzles that surround black holes and our attempts to resolve them have of course led to many major breakthroughs in our understanding of quantum gravity. So one of those major breakthroughs was the Strominger-Wafa microstate counting to explain the origin of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, a classical entropy of black holes. More recently, black holes has famously led to this information paradox that people have been thinking about over the past few decades. And recently there's some breakthrough related to this, which is the reproduction of the page curve using this new idea called the quantum extremal surface. So the focus of this talk is more about, it's more related to this Strominger-Wafa counting. But so notice that their work was done in 1996. That was before the advent of the ADS-CFT, or at least the full description of it by Maldacena. So after ADS-CFT, I would say that this holographic framework provides a different and arguably more rigorous or more refined setting to study the microstate counting. So by now we're all familiar with ADS-CFT. We know that there's state-state correspondence, which means that if you have a black hole in ADS, it's dual to a CFT on the boundary, and the black hole microstates should be accountable by the states in the CFT. One problem that always sort of presents a difficulty in trying to do this kind of microstate counting is that the black hole, the semi-classical description of a black hole is valid at weak coupling in the bulk, but it corresponds to strong coupling in the CFT. So if you want to do this counting in the CFT, it's very difficult to do anything in strong coupling. So one way out has been that so people have typically studied indices, so things that are sort of protected by supersymmetry and therefore are deformation invariant. So then you can do the counting sort of at weak coupling, and then you can argue by the supersymmetry protection that this counting is still valid at strong coupling in the CFT, and hence, you know, it makes sense to match it with black holes, which are semi-classical in the bulk. Well, so the index is it's a partition function, or it's some trace, but it's a trace with signs. So it's some counting with signs. Whereas we expect the black hole entropy to be a counting of states of microstates without signs. So just by pure logic, they don't necessarily have to match, because you could imagine that there's massive cancellations among states, among microstates, and perhaps that would change sort of the asymptotic growth, or just the asymptotic growth of states counted by the index. Well, so that is a logical worry, but in practice, there have been numerous successful matches between the index, the growth of the index, with the semi-classical Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of ADS black holes. The most difficult case, so it was first done in 3D and then generalized to some other situations, but it turns out that the most difficult case is actually the most emblematic example of holography of ADS CFT, which is the original duality between n equals 4 super young Mills on the CFT side and type 2b string theory on ADS 5 times S5 on the bulk side. So in this case, so we said that we wanted to, in order to circumvent this, you know, strong coupling, weak coupling difficulty, people counted indices or relatedly BPS, they counted BPS states. So the expectation is that if you have a solution, a supergravity solution, a supersymmetric one that corresponds to a black hole in ADS, and you look at its Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, it should match with the counting of BPS states on the CFT side in n equals 4. So people tried this, and indeed, so people looked at the index, and this index is some very special quantity. It can be expressed as actually just a finite dimensional integral, n-dimensional integral. And people performed saddle point analysis at large n and wanted to match with the black hole entropy. But the initial attempts wasn't successful. The saddle point analysis revealed only order 1, so n to the 0 entropy, whereas the bulk prediction is n squared. And at the time, people just thought, well, this is probably just because, you know, logically they didn't have to match. And unfortunately, this is the case that, you know, they just didn't match, that there's massive cancellations and there's nothing we can do about it unless we go beyond the index. However, a few years ago, it was understood that this is not entirely the case. So it was a breakthrough by these three groups of people, I think, independently. So it was realized that, well, these large cancellations do happen, but it's not, if you fix the charge, you know, fix all the charges, it's not cancellations, you know, in that fixed charge sector. These are cancellations between nearby charges, which is a result of performing the saddle point analysis in sort of a canonical ensemble way. So there are massive cancellations, but it's between nearby charges. And it turns out that these degeneracies, the signs oscillate rapidly. So if you average over nearby charges, you get, you know, massive cancellations. And one way that these smart people figured out how to circumvent this was to turn on some complex chemical potentials to sort of partially cancel this sign oscillation, so that when you do the average, instead of getting, instead of averaging over some sign, which gives massive cancellation, it's kind of like averaging, almost like averaging over the absolute value. And it just turns out that by doing this, they found order n squared entropy, which matches with the bulk expectation. So this was a pretty big success, and it sort of resolved this, this old problem for n equals four. So, so we want to, so today we want to try to sort of refine this analysis or match, or yeah, this, this microstate counting business in the following way. So first, so there's this state to state-state correspondence between the bulk and the CFT, but not all states in the CFT are dual to singular center black holes in the bulk. This is obvious because it should account for, you can have strings in the bulk, you can have all sorts of other stuff in the bulk, and they should all be accounted for. If they're true quantum states in the ADS, they should be accounted for also by states in the CFT. So, so there can be gravitons, there can be other black objects, not necessarily black holes, and there can also be all sorts of bound states between these different objects. So we can at least first give a rough, there can be a whole zoo of different types of objects, but we can give a rough binary classification of the type of objects that exist in the bulk. So a first type is a gas of gravitons or multigravitons. And one characteristic of these multigraviton states is that as you scale n, their energies, they don't scale with n. Whereas the other objects like black holes or other stuff, for example, giant gravitons, their energies are expected to scale as n to some power. So there's some big qualitative difference between these two. And that's sort of one way to make this rough classification, rough distinction between these two types of objects. And I think very remarkably, actually, I think this is quite underappreciated, is that in this duality involving n equals four, the CFT states dual to the single gravitons or the gas of gravitons are actually known. And it turns out that these states are BPS without the need of trace relations. And therefore, it's obvious that there is no n dependence. So that matches with this expectation, our expectation of what should be dual to a gas of gravitons. And so when I say they're known, I mean, I'll explain it more detail later, but basically we sort of, to some extent, know their form up to some Q exact terms. But of course, the more interesting CFT states would be those that are dual to other objects, let's say black holes or other black objects. So previously, Qiming and Xian, computing an index, they try to construct BPS states in n equals four, and they try to look for states that are not multigravitons. So as I said before, we know what multigravitons look like, and we can construct BPS states and then check whether they are multigravitons. And if they're not, then good. Then we found something that's dual to something more interesting in the bulk. So they did this search about 10 years ago, but to their surprise, they just couldn't find any state. They couldn't find any BPS state that was not of multigraviton form. So all BPS states found were multigravitons. And because of this, at the time, they sort of conjectured that, maybe actually all BPS operators are multigravitons. It led to a lot of puzzles, and they proposed some potential resolutions, but in any case, it created sort of a bizarre puzzle at the time. So this is sort of one of the motivations of of this current work, motivated by this puzzle. I want to stress that so in this microstate counting business, it's almost always the index that, you know, people focus on. The problem of actually constructing states or candidates for black hole microstates, this is a far more complex and difficult task than just index counting. If you're just counting index, at least right now, there's no way to know whether you are counting the first type of objects or the second type of objects. They're all lumped together and with some sign cancellations. It is only by actually constructing what the states look like and checking whether they look like multigravitons that you can really distinguish whether, you know, you have a candidate for something, a candidate dual to something interesting in the bulk. Good. So the main interest today is concerning this puzzle from 10 years ago. So where are the black hole microstates? Why have, you know, Qiming and Xi, you know, looked hard for them but couldn't find them? So let me pause to see if there are any questions. Okay, now let me continue. So here is the strategy for constructing BPS states in n equals four. I'll explain this in more detail soon. But so first we will consider a near BPS Hilbert space of words. So basically this means that this consists of states that are classically BPS. And the task is to try to study, you know, how many, which states are lifted by quantum effects and which are not. The ones that are not lifted are the true BPS states in the interacting n equals four. So we will formulate this BPS condition at weak coupling as a cohomology problem. And then we will argue with certain caveats, a non-normalization property that allows us to trust our results obtained from weak coupling, even in the strong coupling regime. And then we will move on and, you know, actually do the hard work and try to construct the BPS states. And then we will look for candidates of black hole microstates. So this is if you remember anything from my talk today, I hope you can remember this cartoon. So this is what we want to achieve. We will fix all the charges that are available to us. So fix given charges. We will construct explicit finite dimensional vector spaces where true BPS states live. And so here, this is a picture. So think of this V. So this V is the near BPS Hilbert space, which is spanned by the states that are classically BPS. And at restricted to some fixed charges. In each vector space, at very weak coupling, the true BPS state will be, say, a particular vector. And when you crank up the coupling, this vector, you know, it does move around because there are quantum corrections, at finite G. So this purple trajectory, it's very hard to, you know, actually track. You can, say, compute things to a first few orders in perturbation theory. But beyond that, you know, this is very difficult. But our goal is not really to, at least not yet, really to track this purple trajectory. What we want to do is just construct this vector space. So we want to construct this vector space, and we want to, so we will construct a vector space that sort of guarantees the existence of a BPS state, a true BPS state inside. So it's like a trap. It's like you have this vector space and you know that there's a BPS state inside. Where it exactly is, like which vector it is, that is much, much more difficult to answer. But at least we have this vector space. And that is at least enough for if you wanted to count states without signs, for example, but you could also do more things with it. So that's the main cartoon that sort of is representative of the content of this talk or this work. So this was some meme I created when I was giving this talk to an audience that, you know, had a strong interest in quantum information. Basically, my point is just that if you fix the charges, then this vector space is, you know, it's not that big. And later we will see that, so one of the interesting vector spaces that we will find is something like 17 dimensional. So that's why I said 4 qubits here, but the point is just that there's some relatively small Hilbert vector space that supposedly contains interesting black hole physics. Okay, so let me go into more details after giving this cartoon. So first of all, I want to point out that I want to say that the approach that we the method that we have is not, it's actually, so 40 n equals 4 is just particularly nice. Like things that you worry about turn out to just, you know, you worry about them, but then you realize that, oh, you didn't have to worry about them. It's not, one would have to do more work if you want to try to generalize this this approach to other dimensions. But for example, one particularly nice thing that happens in 4D is that, you know, you don't have vortices or monopoles or instantons. So your Hilbert space in the sense of, so your Hilbert space in the sense of say radial quantization or on S3 is really just, you only have to worry about multi-trace expressions of your fundamental fields. You don't have to worry about all these other things. And so if we think of the fields and its derivatives as letters, then every state can be expressed as some linear combination of words. And it turns out that we can, if we're interested in looking for BPS stuff, we can further restrict to the BPS subsector, which are BPS words made of BPS letters. So this is a subset of all the words that one could make. So this is just I just have to write down the n equals 4 super conformal algebra. And so there are 16 supercharges, 16 super conformal charges. The indices are explained as follows. So there are many supercharges and many superconformal charges, but we are only going to pick a conjugate pair of Q and S. So, and in radial quantization, I will call them, there will be Q and Q dagger. So just pick one pair. And we study the BPS bound corresponding to this QQ dagger anti-commutator, which is given by this combination of charges. So BPS bound tells you that this has to be non-negative. And if I say something is BPS, it means that this is saturated. So the near BPS subsector or near BPS Hilbert space, as I sort of alluded to earlier, is the Hilbert space of states that saturate the BPS bound classically. So this combination of charges, so this dilatation, this is some angular momentum, and then R charges. If this combination vanishes, then it's a BPS state classically. Now, so this is classical. Some of these states will be lifted by quantum effects. So they will become non-BPS once you consider the interacting theory. But some of them are not. Some of them are not lifted, and those are the true BPS states in the interacting theory. and so it's a nice fact that because in perturbation theory, classical dimension is conserved. So this means that if we just want to look for BPS states, we can really focus ourselves on first on the near BPS Hilbert space, which is bigger, but my point is that you don't have to worry about, you know, mixing with the classically non-BPS states, at least in perturbation theory. Okay, so here are sort of the fundamental fields in n equals 4. And once we made the choice of this particular pair of supercharge and so QQ dagger, the BPS letters, namely the fundamental fields that classically saturate the BPS bound, are the following. So there's scalar, fermions, and the field strength. And there's also a covariant derivative. And we can conveniently combine these fields into a super field. So you should think of these Zs, or I guess Zs, and thetas as just auxiliary variables. So the Zs are bosonic and the thetas are Grassmann. So you assemble these fields in this way. And so basically the Zs take care of the derivatives, and derivatives in the direction that, you know, makes things still maintains the BPS condition. And then sort of these thetas, of course, just lets us conveniently keep track of the components. So just to give an example, so as I said before, all states can be represented by some multi-trace operator. So this is one example, it's a random example. We can write it in terms of this BPS superfield by just simply taking some theta derivatives, right? So this is the superfield. You take some theta derivatives to bring your component field of interest to the front without any thetas, and then you put them together. So these are all matrix valued, and then you take the trace to make them gauge invariant. So this double trace expression, you know, becomes this guy. So it is a non-trivial fact. It's actually quite non-trivial that when you package all the fields into this BPS superfield, the action of the supercharge on psi can be written in this very compact form. So Q psi commutator is psi squared. This actually already uses the equation of motion. So use the equation of motion and you find that this is a very compact form. Now, so this is classical. What about, you know, quantum mechanically? What about loop effects? So in Lagrangian theories, so for example, we can write the n equals 4 super Young-Mills in n equals 1 superspace. Then if you choose some appropriate supersymmetry preserving regularization, the action of Q on fundamental fields, so on say the components of this BPS superfield, they are undeformed non-perturbatively, right? So if you choose the appropriate regularization. The thing that we have to worry about are the composites of fundamental fields. So at the classical level, how does Q act on composites? Well, it's very simple. You just apply the Leibniz rule. However, quantum effects can change how Q acts on composites. And sometimes it can make the Leibniz rule violated. So this will complicate things. And some of these effects are sort of rigid in the sense that they are dictated by anomalies. So for instance, if the theory suffers or exhibits the axial anomaly or its supersymmetric version, the Konishi anomaly, then the Q action on composites, in addition to the Leibniz rule, there will be some additional, there can be some additional potential contributions. So this issue was actually, we weren't very careful about this when we at least put out the paper. And this was pointed out to us by Justin and Davide. And so we don't have a, we're still trying to formulate a complete rigorous argument, but we do believe that at least in N equals four super young mills, and at least if we focus on Q acting on BPS words, that Leibniz rule holds. And one check of this is, so if you try to just look for, you try to consider some potential, you know, OP singularity between fundamental fields when making composites. So if you consider, for example, phi psi, then you find that, you know, there's some additional contribution that would appear if there's this Kohnichi anomaly. And it just turns out that in N equals four, that the Kohnichi anomaly vanishes. So at least for this particular case, the Leibniz rule is valid. So one has to, you know, just carefully make sure that such issues never just does not arise for Q acting on BPS words in N equals four. So under this working assumption that this belief is, there's no problem with the statement that the Leibniz rule holds.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
So is it true that this Q is the same Q that Bizard computed? So Bizard, yes. When he studied the dilatation operator, he also studied the form of this Q and S, etc. operators.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And so if maybe I'm misremembering, but I thought all these operators do receive loop correction. Isn't Q and S going to become longer and longer range acting on composite ahead. Operators?
Right, let me
they are acting ahead. On more and more legs as you go to higher and higher loops. Is it not true?
So you're talking about the Bizard Hamiltonian, right? Which involves both Q and Q dagger. Right, so you're talking about the anomalous dimensions computed by diagonalizing this H. Mm-hmm. So what you said is 100% correct, that Q dagger does receive quantum corrections. Here, what I'm doing is I'm picking a particular scheme where Q does not receive corrections, but Q dagger does. But as I will explain later, for our purpose, it's okay for, we can be agnostic to the quantum corrections that Q dagger receives. We can formulate this thing as a cohomology problem on Q, which will be equivalent to Bizard's approach of finding the zero eigenstates of H. Does that make sense?
If the last statement is true, if it's equivalent to, will you find the zero eigenstates of H or something?
I will explain it. It's Hodge theory. I'll explain it momentarily.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. Good. So. If you look at this equation, this action of Q, you might first worry that, the right-hand side is psi squared, it looks like a composite, and I just told you that we have to be careful about composite operators. But as a matter of fact, so psi is fermionic. So this psi squared actually, well, if you look at the components, there's some automatic anti-symmetrization or, you know, commutation involved. And it turns out that, you know, there's actually no singularity. There's no coinciding singularity in psi squared. So this actually, you know, makes full sense. So just to summarize, Q acts on the superfield psi in this very simple way. Psi is basically packages all the fundamental fields. And then for composite operators, which, for example, BPS words, we just apply the Leibniz rule. You might be a little confused about like where the coupling depends. I talked about loop effects. So where's the coupling? Well, it is dimensionless. So we have absorbed it into the normalization of fields. That's just for convenience. But importantly, I kept saying that Q does not have corrections, but very importantly, Q dagger does. And I will now explain why we can be, in our approach today, we can be agnostic to the quantum effects, the quantum corrections of Q dagger. Right, this is a very valid worry because BPS states are defined to be annihilated by both Q and Q dagger. So naively, it's a big problem if Q dagger receives quantum corrections. So how can I claim that the result is actually valid to all loop orders, to all orders in perturbation theory? So finding the exact form of a BPS operator is very difficult, at least beyond one loop. So this is, in that cartoon I showed, this is trying to find the exact vector in that vector space. However, determining this finite dimensional vector space where it resides is tractable. And the reason it's tractable, so two ingredients that makes it tractable. First is Hodge theory, and the second is universal coefficient theorem. So let me sketch the argument. So the standard Hodge theory concerns this Laplacian, that is DD dagger, where these are operators acting on just differential forms. So Hodge theory states that every state annihilated by the Laplacian has to take the form of psi plus d phi, where psi is closed, namely that it's annihilated by psi, and this d phi, of course, is Q exact, as the notation suggests. And so this gives a one-to-one correspondence between harmonic forms and Dirac cohomology. So the exact same arguments go through if we just replace D by RQ, and of course D dagger by Q dagger. And then we learn that, computing the Q cohomology gives the vector space of this psi plus Q phi. So let me just say it again. This one-to-one correspondence, it's not some abstract one-to-one correspondence. It's telling you that your harmonic form, the harmonic forms you're looking for, takes this form. It looks like this. It looks like psi plus d phi. So even though it can be very difficult to fix this total expression, we can, through this cohomological approach, one could just try to construct some vector spaces. So we can construct the vector space, a vector space where this all operators of this form reside in. Okay, good. So this is the answer to Pedro's question earlier. That so finding harmonic forms is difficult. So Bizard's computation is very difficult. There are all these quantum corrections, and our goal is to look for the ones that are not lifted, the ones that are not corrected. Right, the true BPS states. And by Hodge theory, we reformulate it into this question about Q cohomology, where we only have to worry about Q, whose action on the BPS words are simple, as we explained, and we can sort of ignore all the complications coming from Q dagger. Okay, so Q is one loop exact. But the Q cohomology, it might not be, because everything can have some kind of formal G expansion, series expansion in G, if you consider perturbation theory. However, if we stick to perturbation theory, we can argue that the cohomology is actually one loop exact. And it's a very simple argument. One just invokes the universal coefficient theorem. So, let's see. So if I just denote this cohomology by, you know, just symbolically by this H star, Q, R, where R is the coefficient, at one loop order, this coefficient is just C, it's just complex numbers. In perturbation theory, you know, operators get renormalized as some formal power series in G. So we can replace that coefficient by this formal series, denoted by this double bracket. And the universal coefficient theorem will tell you that, well, actually the cohomology just factorizes in this simple way. And therefore, if you compute it at one loop, which corresponds to this piece, you also know the answer. It is the answer at all loops. So this, this factorization is not entirely trivial. For example, if you replace this formal power series ring by a polynomial ring, so the G expansion truncates at finite order, this is false. And that's why this is, I stress that this is, this works in perturbation theory. But whether it holds non-perturbatively, we don't have an argument along these lines. Yeah, so non-perturbatively, it is expected. This non-normalization is expected. It was conjectured in this paper long before we gave this perturbative argument. First of all, you know, n equals 4 has S duality. So there are in this in the coupling space or the conformal manifold, there are infinitely many weakly coupled points. And in the perturbation theory around each weakly coupled point, you know, you have this argument that it's non-normalized to all orders in perturbation theory. And the fact that, you know, you have infinitely many weakly coupled points sort of covering this conformal manifold, it makes it sort of, it's not too unbelievable that, you know, this non-normalization holds even non-perturbatively. And another comment is that we're dealing with a superconformal theory here. N equals 4 is superconformal. So this perturbation theory, it's not just perturbation theory, it's actually conformal perturbation theory. And even though I don't know how to make the statement precise, but we do expect conformal perturbation theory to have, you know, much better convergence properties than just standard perturbation theory. So it is believed that this non-normalization argument holds even non-perturbatively, even though the argument I gave above is in perturbation theory. So just to recap, the actual vector, the actual harmonic form, it's very difficult. It depends on on Q dagger, and hence it depends on this coupling. It's very hard to track this purple trajectory. It's hard to track this red arrow. But this vector space does not, is not affected by the coupling. So our strategy is, we'll not attempt to, you know, construct this red arrow. We'll just attempt to construct this vector space. And as we argue, this vector space, the fact that there's a BPS operator, a true BPS operator residing in such a vector space, is a statement that's valid to all loops, to all orders in perturbation theory. And it turns out that some of the vector spaces that we construct do contain candidates for black hole microspaces. So earlier I said that we know, well, Qiming and Xi in figured out the precise form of multi-graviton operators. So let me just say a few words about it. So it's very simple to state. So single gravitons are dual to this Q cohomology, but restricted to single traces. So You see, this is an example where there's only one trace, and then you know you can take this is not just an example. This is actually the most general form of a single trace expression that is inside the Kugel homology. And it's obvious that, you know, this expression, there's no, you don't need any trace relation. So this thing is in the cohomology, no matter what n is, it does not scale with n. So it's kind of natural to expect that these give multigravitons. But furthermore, their products give multigravitons. And furthermore, if you count the number of such expressions at large n, you can also match it with some counting you can do in the bulk. So that's some evidence that these are indeed the duals of single graviton states, and their products are indeed the duals of multigravitons.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So,
yeah.
So first, is it obvious that these states have zero energy? For me, it's not obvious. I look at them. If I multiply a product of these states, is it obvious that it's BPS? Is there some simple algebra I should do in my head, using the relations that you wrote before, that Q1 psi gives psi squared or something, or it's non-trivial?
Great question. So I'm only writing a representative in the cohomology. So if you just take a representative, it might not be the harmonic form. So basically here, I'm just giving you a random vector inside this vector space. And I'm saying that that's a representative of the cohomology. The actual harmonic form might be some very complicated combination of this operator with some Q exact expression. And I don't know what the Q exact expression looks like. So when I earlier said that we know what single graviton states look like, I only meant it in the cohomology sense. I only mean that we know that every BPS graviton operator is related to such an expression by a Q exact term. Okay, I hope that answers.
Let me just think. Mm-hmm. So the true state is this plus Q of something?
Yes.
So if I act now with Q on this, I kill that something, right? Q squared will be zero?
Yes. Yes, but it's not killed by Q dagger.
But it will not be killed by Q dagger. Okay.
Yes. You have to find a very particular combination of this and some Q exact expression for it to be actually killed by Q dagger, say at one loop.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, so just to reiterate, this representative is just some vector in this vector space. The true BPS state, the true harmonic form, is related by a Q exact term. And in order for it to be actually annihilated by both Q and Q dagger, you need to find that actual combination. But that's not what we're doing here. We're giving a representative in the cohomology. So, okay, good. So, the thing we do in this work is basically we construct the Q cohomology, and we just check if the Q cohomology contains a multigraviton representative. So, if we find some Q cohomology, representative of Q cohomology that cannot be related to an operator of this form by a Q exact term, it means we have something that is not just a multigraviton. So it's something interesting in the bulk. So I will skip these computational details. So I'll just say we work with fields in component form, and let me skip the computational details. It's the bottleneck is actually some. It's just we're doing basically linear algebra on very large matrices, and that's like the computational bottleneck. Okay, so if you want to look at our data, I put it on my GitHub. I will present some data, and so there are many charges, and so I cannot draw like a six-dimensional. I cannot present data in a six-dimensional space. So it is. I'm going to follow the custom to ignore all the R charge fugacities, and only track a certain combination of energy and momentum, which is this N here. So let me explain what this is. So for N equals 2, N equals 3, N equals 4, we separately did this explicit enumeration. The black dots are, so we count the dimension of the Q cohomologies without signs. That gives the black dots. So for each fixed charge N, this is sort of the degeneracy in log scale. And then the hollow dots, these circles, are the counting with signs. So these should match with the index, and indeed they do. So our explicit enumeration, there's a sanity check, which is just you combine them with signs and you should reproduce the index. And we can check that with existing literature. So they all check out. Okay, good. So the important thing is that, this is basically, so at N equals 25, it's already, you know, close to our current, the current limitation of our computational power. But very fortunately, at this relatively high level, so N equals 24 or SU2, we did find some cohomology that does not contain a multigraviton representative. So it cannot be written, so it's not, these are not multigravitons. And so below 24, what we found was that all the Q cohomologies can be interpreted as multigravitons. And here I'm writing out explicitly the charges of the only non-multigraviton states that we found. And I will remark that the charges, namely especially the energy, is relatively high compared to the naive expectation from the bulk. So from the bulk, we expect that black holes roughly begin at energy n squared. For n equals 2, that means 4, whereas, you know, this number is closer to 10. So it's like almost, it's like twice the expectation. And let me also note that some other large objects, for example, giant gravitons, they begin also at n to some power. So for giant gravitons, it's linear in n. And we don't, So it's kind of it's kind of high compared to the energy is kind of high compared to the expectation. But we do believe that this is just a small n effect. This is n equals 2. This is SU2. And for giant gravitons, we expect it to start at, you know, energy 2. Of course, you can also, like, it is logically possible that the state we found is not really a black hole. It's some giant graviton. It's some other object in the bulk. But because the bulk expectation of them appearing is actually at lower energy, it would be even more surprising if, you know, they were there. And if we assume that the state we found here is, say, a black hole, the fact that we didn't find any Q cohomology below it sort of suggests that, you know, quantum mechanically or in quantum gravity, these giant gravitons are actually just, you can think of them as composites of gravitons. They're actually multi-graviton states that just have some, you know, semi-classical, that just appears as some semi-classical solution of supergravity. And, you know, the fact that we had to go to this sort of unexpectedly high charge or energy to find the first non-multigraviton state sort of explains why the search from 10 years ago was not successful. And so this cohomology, this non-multigraviton state that we found, at n equals 24. A very nice thing about it is that the Q-hole homology is one dimensional. So it means that, well, all multigraviton operators are Q-exact. This is by our explicit check. And so it follows that any Q-close operator that is not Q-exact must be the unique non-graviton state. And shortly after our paper appeared, these people, they used our information to analytically construct a simple representative of the cohomology that we found of this non-graviton state. It's important. So I will note that if they knew where, like, what charges to look for the non-graviton state, this is some what's difficult but finite amount of work to, you know, construct something that and check that it's Q-close and not Q-exact. What is almost impossible to do by hand is to check that that state is not a multigraviton operator. So for that fact, they sort of relied on our data. Otherwise, even though they construct this operator, they won't know whether it's actually a candidate black hole microstate. So for the interest of time, let me skip the giant graviton discussion. And I'll just mention some prospects or some things that I hope will happen in this business of black hole microstate counting or microstate construction. So we constructed this vector space, and I said, well, it's practically almost impossible to really find this actual BPS state, this red arrow. But I don't know, one could imagine that there might be some kind of optimization procedure, you know, some functional that one tries to optimize that gives, you know, a vector that best mimics a black hole. And I think it'll be very nice if, you know, we can look at states that should correspond to black holes or candidate black holes, and then states that are multigravitons. And if there's something that we can measure to tell that, you know, to tell their qualitative differences, yeah, I think that would be pretty nice. So this is just some slogan. I like to call this the Black Hole Genome Project because it's going beyond what's usually done, which is just looking at the counting of the index. We're actually constructing states.
Can I ask a question? So yeah. You found this one single state at this level n equals 24.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you know this state is there, you said, can you construct really the state that has energy equal to zero, or you just know that the state is there? Could you find the state?
The answer is no. So in that case, the vector space is, I think, 17 or 18 dimensional. So it means that, so you can write down a basis for this whole vector space, but you cannot pinpoint exactly which state has zero energy or it saturates the BPS bound.
But it's 17 dimensional.
Yes, around.
Why can't you just write a combination of a vector with 17 components, act with Hamiltonian, and see and fix the linear combination to get zero?
You can at fixed loop order. You could. So if I decided I want to just find the answer at one loop order, I can construct the Q dagger at one loop, which actually looks like this, and just act on it, and you will find an answer. Yes.
Okay. Did someone do it? Is it written somewhere what the operator looks like?
No. Okay. Not yet. Not yet. Okay. Yeah, it's something that should be done. Yeah, you can also do it just at tree level, and then, you know, you can also just act by the Q dagger at tree level. You should also find some answer. And if one is brave, one could go to also two loop or higher, but So let me end by just mentioning some things in this in this business that I hope I like to see happen. So first, Pedro mentioned this Spicer Hamiltonian, which is basically, it should capture the anomalous dimensions in this near BPS Hilbert space. And there's some expectation that this near BPS Hilbert space captures not just the BPS black hole, but also some small excitations on top of it. And there's some suggestion that this is actually described by some n equals two super Schwarzian, this studied by these people. So I think it would be very nice if one could start with this Spicer Hamiltonian and somehow relate it to this super Schwarzian, or just come up with some effective theory that describes near horizon excitations. So the Hamiltonian using our BPS superfield, it can be written in this compact form. And one can also try to write down some action in this auxiliary superspace that reproduces this Hamiltonian. Unfortunately, it's bilocal, so it's kind of hard to deal with. But at least one could imagine that maybe if one is able to solve the equation of motion and evaluate the on-shell action, maybe one would directly discover the black hole entropy. So that's one thing. Another thing is about the microstate counting of other black objects. So there's a famous black ring problem, which is, in the original Schrödinger-Wolf context, there's this D1, D5 CFT, and it is known that, well, the elliptic genus, which is this protected index, it only accounts for the entropy of BPS black holes, but not BPS black rings that have the same asymptotic charges. So one outstanding question is, does the D1, D5 CFT know about these other black objects like black rings? Are they still captured by BPS states that just happen to cancel out in the elliptic genus? Or even though the classical solution is BPS, maybe quantum mechanically they're slightly lifted. Are they like near BPS instead of BPS? So in the first scenario, this can in principle be studied by just studying the lifting in D1, D5. It might be computationally very difficult, but it's in principle doable. The second scenario, I think, is the more difficult one. I'm not sure how to tackle it. And then we also have some ideas to maybe not consider K3, but consider M3 on some more generic Calabi-Yau, and maybe the black rings can be counted by certain topological invariants.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So how does the entropy of a BPS black ring compared to a large BPS black hole in this context? Is it always subdominant, or how do they compare?
So to compare them, one should fix the angular momentum. So there's J left and J right. And for black holes, J right always vanishes, so you only have J left. Whereas for black rings, you can have both. So suppose you had a state that had, say large JR, then you know that it should not be a black hole, but it's black ring. So if you fix the charge in this way, then the black ring will not be dominated by black holes. But if you choose a charge where both black holes and black rings can coexist, then yes, black rings are dominated by black holes. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So you'd be focusing on the sector where J right is non-zero, essentially?
Yes. And even just for J left. So J left for black holes, there's sort of a maximum. There's some maximum amount of J left. But for black rings, that can go above. So if you look at, even if you ignore J right, if you just look at something like the index or these Kupakumar-Wolf invariants, you don't have information about J right. If you just look at J left, for J left exceeding a certain amount, you know that there cannot be large black hole solutions. So if you find any macroscopic entropy there, it also has to be something else that's not black holes, and you can ask if it's a black ring.
I see.
Yeah. Okay, so let me actually just end here, and I welcome more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ying. Any further questions? Fun memes, by the way.
So, can I ask a question? So, what is the smallest subsector where you expect to have this non-multigraviton states? Do you need all these fields that you considered, or now, or do you think that at heavier levels there are other states in smaller subsectors?
I think, let me see. So it is known that macroscopic black holes can only exist if it's 1/16 BPS and not 1/8, or not in smaller subsectors. But if you're only asking about a pure CFT question, you're asking whether non-multigravitons can exist in smaller subsectors. That's not clear. It's not clear to me. I would guess no, but I don't have an argument.
Let me ask you a question. So if I have 2.5 BPS operators, say trace of Z square and trace of Z square. Of course, these are half BPS, right? Each of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the product is also half BPS. But now if I take these 2.5 BPS operator, say trace of Z square and trace of Z to the 4, for example, and I put derivatives in the middle of the two. Some derivative in some light cone direction in the middle of the two. So trace of Z square, a bunch of derivatives, and then trace of Z to the 4.
Okay.
This I know as zero anomalous dimension at one loop. But is this obvious? Is this a multigraviton state? And is it? Would you say that this should have zero anomalous dimension at all loops?
But by the way, that operator is no longer half BPS.
Oh, wait.
That operator naively is no longer half BPS, all right?
Yes.
But it has zero anomalous dimension at one loop.
At one loop. Let's see. So if the normalization theorem property is true, then it would suggest that it should have zero anomalous dimension at all loops.
Isn't it just a descendant?
No, because the derivatives are in the middle of the trace. So if it was derivatives of the two traces, fine. But I put a trace, then I put derivatives, then I put the other trace.
Okay.
So the generalization would be like three traces. Trace, 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 and now put derivatives in two of them only, any combination you want of derivatives in some light cone direction. I would claim this as 0-1 loop anomalous dimension. But I suspect, but I would like to know if it's true or not. I suspect it has two loop anomalous dimension.
And this is for any n. This is for this. Yeah. This does not care about the trace relation.
No.
It's a bit puzzling to me because for that general form of operators, I would imagine that you can realize them at very relatively small charges. And I did not find a cohomology.
It's probably what Jiun said, that these operators are not BPS, right?
even classically?
Perhaps, yeah.
I think they're classically BPS. Yeah. If the derivatives are BPS as well.
Sorry, you say they are or they are not?
They're not half BPS, but
they're not, right?
Lower fraction BPS.
Classically.
Yeah.
I see. So you expect these to be classically at least 116 BPS, at least some for some choice of components, it's 116 BPS, but classically, but the expectation is that it does get anomalous dimension at two loops. That's the claim.
I mean, this was something many, many years ago, I computed anomalous dimension of these guys just for fun, and it was zero. Okay. And then I don't know, it's in some notebook somewhere. But because I was not expecting to find zero, I was expecting to find that these traces are like two planets and they rotate around each other and there is some binding energy, and I wanted to compute this binding energy, and but okay, it was zero. I said, okay, maybe it's non-zero at the next two orbit, and I dropped it. But so I mean, it's not surprising that something could be zero at one loop and not zero beyond one loop. So it's a bit new what you are saying, that there are some statements like that for dimensions of operators that one loop would be enough. I'm not used to it.
Yeah, that's so if there's that example, then you're saying that it would be a caveat, or it would be a counterexample to the non-renormalization claim I have here. That's the statement, right?
I don't know. You have all these brackets.
Right, so
it's hard for me. I don't know. Double bracket for me is to take an element of it.
Ignoring the arguments, the statement I made was that if it's one loop, if it's BPS one loop, it should be BPS all loops. But you're saying that you think you have a counterexample.
I think these operators cannot. I think these operators, when you have two BPS operators and then you put three of this in the middle, and not. Of course, not a descendant, but in the middle. I think they are BPS at one loop. I think they cannot be BPS completely, because I think these operators, at strong coupling, I think people see the anomalous dimension of these operators because they study the four-point functions. And I think these operators would show up in most representations that... people that study, that try to bootstrap this Malin amp with that strong coupling, I think they use the anomalous dimension of these guys. They solve the degeneracy and compute their anomalous dimensions and find some non-zero results. I think this is not something I've worked on, but I thought that the picture should be that at one loop it's zero, eventually it's not zero, at strong coupling it's something.
I see. Okay, so if at one, okay, so it's in the near BPS Hilbert space, because classically it is 116 BPS, and if it's true that, so if that one loop is zero, it must be accounted for, it must be in the Q cohomology that we computed. So, right, so that's so it's a pretty sharp objection to the non-normalization proposal. Yeah, I don't know the answer, but we should definitely look into it.
So you see, this is so this ties back to my other question. So that's why I was asking whether these operators that you wrote with some derivatives outside the traces, whether it was obvious why they were BPS, because I was just wondering if there was such an argument. I could imagine recycling this argument to understand why was I getting zero, because I have BPS and derivatives in the middle. And so for me, it's not obvious. That doesn't look BPS to me.
So let me see. So
but this, as you said, this is not a BPS operator. It's just a representative in the same vector space as the BPS operator, etc. So it's not as straightforward.
The operator that you described is a multigraviton form, right? So this is the single graviton expression, which is a single trace. A multigraviton is just the product of such operators.
If I understood correctly your notation, I have to be careful with where these derivatives act and this is equal to zero, etc. This is not exactly the same as...
Oh,
The fact that you need only derivatives of type Z acting on psi, and I thought there was some condition on the sum of these P's and Q's and M's or whatever, right? It's not anything goes, right? Here. Is it true or not that there was some selection rule?
It's not, well, I had thought that these like K's and M's were general.
They can be whatever they want?
I think so. I think these P's, Q's, K's, and M's can be whatever they want.
Can you match it to the single graviton, like, I guess, Hilbert, like, you should be able to match the counting, right?
Yeah, well, I'm saying, so it's a double trace, so it should not be a single graviton, but it does look like a look like a two graviton form, right? It's a trace, derivative trace type of expression. But if it is a multigraviton, I would expect that what's in the Q-cohomology, and at least we expect that it would not be renormalized, even if you go to higher loops. But you say that there's some counter evidence to this, that
at least, if it is true what you are saying, if it's a BPS, I think in that, okay, then I would like to understand why it would be BPS. I mean, to me, it's very far. It doesn't look obvious at all why it is. BPS.
Wait, let me think. As I said before, this is just a representative, so it's not truly BPS. So maybe what we're saying is that the operator that you wrote down is related to a BPS operator by a Q exact term, but it itself is not BPS. Right, so then it could have an anomalous dimension.
Okay.
So
I should try to construct, I should try to see if people know the two loop non-planar Hamiltonian in this SL2 sector. And if so, I should try to act and check my statement. But I will be very surprised if it's still zero. Because people like Aprile, Simon Caronot, Aldai, mm-hmm. and others, they are studying this P1, P2, P3, P4, 4-point functions, right? Of operators mm-hmm. of different sizes that strong coupling, and they decompose into these arc charge representations, and mm-hmm. they find all these anomalous dimensions there for the double traces. And what are these double traces? It's exactly BPS, BPS with derivatives in the middle, right? It's exactly what these double traces are.
Right.
And that's right. Exactly what they are studying anomalous dimensions all the time. So it's not, I don't think it's as simple as saying if you put a product with derivatives in the middle, it's BPS. Yeah. That's typically not true.
Right. So I should have made the distinction clear between actual BPS states and just representative. So here, this is a representative. So
right.
My claim would be that by adding some Q exact term, I should have a true BPS state. And for a simple enough expression, I mean, the Q exact term lives in some finite dimensional Hilbert space. So presumably if they computed the 4-point function that included these additional possible Q exact terms and look at this, you know, some kind of, you know, matrix of anomalous dimensions, anomalous matrix, and then there should be some zero eigenvalues. That would be the prediction.
Right. But I think what Pedro is saying is also representative, right, Pedro? Because to have the BPS state, you need to consider permutations of these derivatives that you choose to act on only on one of the traces. But you want to act on all of them with some linear combination that's fixed by the Hamiltonian.
No, it's literally what I said. Operator, derivatives, operator.
That diagonalize the Hamiltonian?
Yeah.
Why is it not like 2 is 2? Single traces?
Because there's no cyclicity when you multiply two objects that are not inside a matrix. Note that it's zero, right? You are after an eigenstate at zero. So if you have an eigenstate that gives zero and you add to it plus a descendant, it's still zero. Plus a second descendant, it's still zero. And you can put with any three coefficients you want, right? So the difference between my state and your state are what Jaume said. It's descendants, right? Because they have zero eigenvalue, I can add to my state a total derivative. That's fine. That's also a descendant. So it's stronger. My statement is really the state that I said is has zero anomalous dimension at one loop.
It's still very puzzling to me, because if it is zero, has zero anomalous dimension at one loop, then it would be the harmonic form in whatever vector space that I constructed. So it would.
Harmonic form. Yeah, so maybe it is zero to all loops, and then at strong coupling, my statement that it has an anomalous dimension is wrong, because I need to be more careful about the group theory, and most representations have anomalous dimension, but some extreme anomalous dimensions with, I don't know, some fully symmetric boxes or whatever. Maybe my mistake is.
I think my feeling is that, so the harmonic form itself is a formal series in the coupling. So if you only work at one loop, you get a particular expression. If you go to two loops, you would have to correct your original operator by some G dependent, something that's proportional to G squared or mm-hmm. G to some power, for it to remain no anomalous dimension at two loops. So I wonder if the problem is that that the operator that has no anomalous dimension at two loops is related by the operator that you studied by a term that's proportional to some power of g. So if you ignore that, then you would find anomalous dimension at two loops. But if you include that, then you would find a VPS state at two loops. That to me seems like the right now the only logical way out.
Okay. Anyway, if no one thinks it's a triviality, I'll try to find the Hamiltonian. I should do it. It's z squared, z squared. Size 4 compared to your size 24 and supercomputer. Mine, I can do on the blackboard, obviously.
right. Okay, but this is interesting. Interesting. So I think, okay, so what I was saying was that you computed an operator that is annihilated by Q dagger at one loop. Namely, it's annihilated by this guy. But Q dagger receives quantum corrections at also two loops. So the two loop correction. So there's something, you add some G stuff to it. And correspondingly, to maintain zero eigenvalue, you should also deform your operator by something, by a term that's depending on G. So my feeling is that because you did not add that term, you find non-zero anomalous dimension. And had you added that term, then you would again find zero. I mean, there's a very concrete computation to do, right? So as you said, you have it's a very simple operator. I think the space of all the possible Q exact terms is also very tiny. I think it's very tiny. And one could, you know, literally just compute the dilatation matrix and just to check if there's a zero eigenvalue.
Yeah.
I think. So you say the vanishing of the one loop is it's not written anywhere, is It's, you just did it.
Yeah, it's not written anywhere now. Yeah, I did many years ago when I was a student. I showed it to Bizard and to Zwibble at the time. They did not know why it was there, but they also did not care much, like I did not at the time. But now it looks interesting.
So this is not a counterexample to the non-renormalization theorem, right?
Not until you find that two loop is not zero, Arish. Yeah. Arish is trying to start implement, play a little bit with these Hamiltonians and so on.
I see. Maybe can I ask you for the precise form of the operator you considered maybe later? I think you asked me about acting by the one loop Q dagger or maybe two loop Q dagger, right? So at least for one loop, it's something that one should do, and presumably that's equivalent to what you did, and it would just be a nice check.
Yes. And I can tell now it's trace z square. It's trace of z to the n any power.
Okay.
Trace of z to any other power you want, and in the middle, put any number of covariant derivatives in one light cone direction. Say d plus to.
Okay.
So d plus to the s, acting on the second trace times the first trace. With any power j1, any power j2, and any power of derivatives in the middle.
Okay.
This has zero anomalous damage.
Okay.
So these are bound states of like conformally soft gravitons or whatever. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this should be a bound state of each trace is like a state. You have these gravitons, and if the spin is large, they should be far away, and the anomalous dimension should decay with the spin. Should be 1 over the spin square, probably, which is like a Coulomb force, right? So you separate them and you measure the binding energy between the two. And this is very different from the twist two operators, that the energy grows logarithmically because it's a string and it's becoming bigger. So the energy is becoming bigger. And so with integrability, people study a lot the energy of these spinning strings that grows with spin. And I wanted to have an example of an energy that decays with spin because it's more like two planets that are going far away. So I wanted to compute this function of S and then take S to be large and study what's happening. And then when I computed, I got zero. Okay.
Sorry. So are they separated? It's smeared along the light cone direction, or is it like
there's this idea that large spin is like large impact parameter. So when you have these two operators, giving them large spin is making them rotate around each other very fast, which effectively separates them because so there are these papers by Zohar and Zhiboyedov, and
I think I'm just viewing the spin a little bit. I mean, it's like the separation is still along the light condor coordinate, not like a
in global ADS, you should really think you have the cylinder, and now you have two planets far away on the cylinder in the middle of global ADS rotating very fast, really like a spiral. So I see what you are saying. You are wondering about the light cone direction. The light cone direction is not crucial. It is just that it's any symmetric traceless tensor of large spin. Putting all indices plus is just one choice of component, but there's only one component anyway. So it's just a way of extracting that spinning operator. Right. You can say it's trace of z to the j1 and then many derivatives with fully symmetric indices mu1 up to mu j and then another BPS operator.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I just normally deal with the flat limit of the bulk and I don't. And it's.
And just to make sure, so you claim the vanishing of the anomalous dimension at one loop is true even for more than two traces. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. I see. So then it has to be that. That sounds like it's a very large subclass of the multi-graviton states. And if they all have vanishing anomalous dimension on one loop, there must be some simple derivation of it by just acting the explicit this Q dagger on it and just to find that it's annihilated. This is the one loop this is the one, the Q dagger.
Yeah.
Isn't the most likely resolution? Isn't the most likely resolution of the puzzle just that it has no anomalous dimension to all loops, like you're saying?
But
I mean, there was not. What's the strong motivation that the two loops it's zero?
I think. Well, first, if you put derivatives. Well, most operators are not BPS, right? So that's the first argument. Most things that you write, I mean, they are just not BPS. If you write an operator with derivatives, like twist three operators, twist four, twist five, they are not BPS. They have some anomalous dimension. And now you put derivatives, not descendants, but derivatives sprinkled in the BPS operators. They don't have a reason to be BPS. I think typically they will not be BPS.
But
like twist four operators are not BPS.
But there is no example. There is that another example where you have zero, one loop anomalous dimension and no two loops? Unless it's BPS two loops.
But one has to be a bit careful, right? Because the operators, again, it's in perturbation theory, it's some form of series in the coupling, right? So when you say the same operator at one loop and two loop, are you adding some correction by G or are you not? I think one has to be very careful.
Yeah, but Alexander is being careful. It's just we have the operator is labeled, but it's all no one. Yeah, we know that the form of the operator will change, of course, as we are moving.
Mm-hmm.
So that is fine. I think some people know of examples where things start at two loops and not at one loop, but not for a single string. But I think there are often cases where these kind of things could have some reason that. Is kinematic or some conservation law that you need to exchange two gravitons or something that could explain some delay in perturbation theory. There are some stuff in BFKL physics that starts at two loops because of that. So not in planar physics that I know. Typically when things can happen, they typically happen at one loop, but not everything. There are things that happen later that I think phases show at higher order. There are many things in integrability, as you know, that start later.
Yeah.
But zeros, for example, there are many three-point functions that are zero, right? As you know, at one loop, right, and that are not at two loops. So three-point function is an example.
Right, right.
So, but the spectrum?
Yeah, no. Okay, no, I'm convinced. Now I can think of many examples. But,
yeah.
I support the two loops, not zero. Dimension.
But my main argument was strong coupling. I think what Francesco studied with all these boxes and so on, I think translates into computing this anomalous dimension of these guys at strong coupling, and they are there. But there could be reorganization of the states. Maybe the way I'm thinking that with all this level crossing in between weak and strong coupling, maybe things reorganize so much that it's a bit hard to draw conclusions. The scientific way to do is to compute the Hamiltonian at two loops and just act on these very small states and see. I forgot if the Hamiltonian is known beyond the planar limit at two loops. At one loop, I know it is. Arish, do you know?
Yeah, it is known. But it is known? I am okay. Trying to decode that language, yeah.
Okay, well, you should tell us tonight.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, I gotta go pick up my daughter. Thanks for the talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ing.
Yeah, thank you all.
Can I have a question before you go?
Of course.
So you found this non-multi-graviton cohomology class for n equals 2. So do I understand correctly, there should be like a family for each n and at large n that's dual to the black hole?
There should be a family. Well,
I'm wondering whether the non-multigraviton cohomology classes for other n, if they're like of similar of like or like or of the same form as the one for n equals to 2, or they can be just random but like together dual to that.
So it depends on what you mean by the same form. So they cannot look exactly the same as a trace expression because these non-multigraviton states, or at least the black hole states are expected to grow with n, right? So something that you find at n equals 2, when you go to say n equals 10, you don't expect to find any black hole state at that charge. But if by the same form you mean you have a proposal for a family of expressions that actually grow in complexity with n, then that's possible, but we don't have any guess for what that family could be at the moment. So,
but yeah. Could it just be that there's like no family and they are just random homology classes?
Yeah, they could be. Yeah, I don't, yeah.
Okay, thank you.